Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Anne Gill. My registration number is 14610. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant Michelle Zadra. I'd like to address two of the issues that were briefed. I would like to focus on the challenge to the verdict forms and the suppression motion. The charges in this case revolved around whether there had been the violation of the attorney-client privilege of Joe Strohmeyer, an inmate in the Gunnison County Jail. It's important to keep that focus because all the charges have the element of knowing as a component of them. And in addition, the perjury charges also have element of materiality of statements that were alleged to be perjury. The verdict forms do not include the element of knowing on any of the charges. Because the evidence in this case really revolved around whether the statements were made knowingly, the lack of that element in the verdict form was prejudicial to the defendant.
Was knowingly in the instruction?
Yes, it was.
Does it have to be repeated in the verdict form?
I did not find any direct authority on that. I think in this particular situation where the knowing element was so critical that the phrasing in the verdict forms, which basically were, we find the defendant not guilty when she gave a false statement. I think that it was important to include that element of knowing in this particular case based on the way it was postured, because the verdict form, by not repeating that element, but also saying that there were false statements, put the focus in the wrong place so that the jury was led into not focusing on a critical element of the charges. In addition to the lack of the element of knowing on all of the verdict forms, at least three of the perjury charges revolved around statements that were not relevant to whether the attorney-client privilege had been violated. Count four talks about whether there had been training to access the phone bank. That does not go to whether attorney-client privilege was violated.
Is that the test for perjury? Is that the statement must be related to attorney-client privilege, or is it that it's a false statement given under oath and that is material?
The materiality has to go to the underlying issue. The case of Onorata, if I have the name correctly, was a case in which there was a perjury charge, and the underlying issue was whether there had been intimidation relating to a recall petition. And the defendant was convicted, but the conviction was reversed in this court because what he had stated was he was not aware of a recall petition. That did not go to whether there was intimidation in the recall. But although they did say that it was a false statement that and he did know about the recall petition, it did not go to the underlying issue of intimidation in the recall election. And I think that is directly analogous to this. If the underlying issue was the attorney-client privilege violated, when they're asking about, did you train anyone to access the phone bank, that does not go to the attorney-client privilege. Similarly, the question and answer, did anyone know how to access the phone bank, does not go directly to whether there was a violation of the attorney-client privilege.
Well, it goes in part to it, because it goes in part to who could listen to the conversation in the first place, which is obviously a prerequisite. It's part of listening to attorney-client privilege communications.
You can make that, but just as in the Onorata case, asking the statement he didn't know about the recall petition, you could say, well, that's a first step to getting to whether there was intimidation. I think that you've got to see the direct relationship, and this was not material to the attorney-client privilege. It was leading up to it. I would say it doesn't get close enough.
But listening to the conversation is an element of the offense, or if there was an underlying offense. Mere listening, that's something that has to be proved. And so didn't that evidence go directly to who could listen? She basically testified these other employees couldn't listen.
No, she said that she didn't know that anyone knew how to access it.
I thought she testified affirmatively that no one could. that she had not trained anyone, no one could access.
I believe the testimony is that she had not trained anyone. To her knowledge, no one knew how to access it.
Okay, and it turns out that was false.
It turns out that she was mistaken, yes. So this is why it's so important to focus on when she learned that her statements were false. And I would submit to you that there's not proof that she knew prior to the Strohmeyer hearing that the statements were false.
Counsel, going back to this issue of knowingly in the verdict form, so the absence of that word, if I understand your argument correctly, it seems to be that because of the inclusion of this other language, that the intent element, the knowingly, had to be included as well. But you're not saying that all of the language should have been included. I mean, it's just because of the existence of this language, you should have also included other language. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so ideally you would say none of this language should have been in there. Is that right? The language about when she provided false information, that clause.
No, it's hard to second guess that now, but I think that if they had that when she gave a false statement, they should have said whether it was knowingly false. So,
but you're not saying that a verdict form must repeat all the elements of an offense, are you?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm saying that with the posture of this case and the nature of the defense, that the omission of the word knowing in the verdict form became prejudicial.
Well, let me ask you, when you contrast the not guilty and guilty parts of the verdict form, and they each use that language, I think when she gave the false statement, wouldn't the difference between not guilty and guilty be that because of this element that wasn't listed as opposed to the language that was listed both times?
I think that as lawyers, we do tend to focus on that. I think you have to understand the jury looking at that. And I asked a number of people, what's their reaction? If I ask you, is a person guilty or not guilty of perjury when he gives a false statement? And the instinctive reaction is, he gave a false statement, it's perjury. I think that in this circumstance, the omission of the word knowing is critical and really was prejudicial to the defense in this case, because so much turned on that. And that really is highlighted by one of the evidentiary errors in this case.
Was there any issue that it was a false statement?
No. By the time of this trial, it was clear that it was a false statement.
So it was undisputed it was a false statement?
Yes. One of the evidentiary rulings in this case was Agent Haynes, who conducted the interview of the defendant, testified as to his belief that she was giving false information. There was an objection to that, which was overruled. That was a clear error. And because so much of this case turned on the credibility of the defendant, to have a witness testify as to her credibility was highly prejudicial.
Counsel, do you recall from the record what the context of that testimony was? What was the purpose of eliciting it, if you can recall from the context of the record?
My recollection, and I believe this is on page 630 of the transcript, is why did you question the defendant? I believe she was holding back information. I believe she was giving false information.
So, are you aware of the Davis case that was decided on Monday by the Supreme Court?
Oh my, yes.
Okay. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that where a statement seemingly of this nature is offered to prove why an investigation was continuing or the direction it was taking, it's admissible.
Yes, and I would say that at this point, the investigation had been into other unrelated issues. There were issues of contraband and improper conduct in the jail, and suddenly there's this switch of, did Michelle Zadra give false statements at the Strohmeyer hearing? So there was no indication at that time that there was an investigation into what Ms. Zadra had done at the Strohmeyer hearing. I would say that the focus had been entirely on missing pills, assaults, and sexual misconduct in the jail.
Well, the consent form she signed for the polygraph examination which preceded the questioning we're talking about, says, quote, Agent Masich, and I don't know how to pronounce that, has advised me that he is investigating the matter of court statements regarding inmate phone conversations, and she signed that. That was before she was questioned. So she was on notice that that was subject to questioning.
That was the only notice she had, and that she had understood that the subject was otherwise, and that the investigation was into issues within the jail. So bringing up the phone monitoring issue was a surprise at that point. But I think this leads into my whole concern about the voluntariness of the statements that she made in that interview. I believe that it was custodial. It was conducted in the police interview room at the police station with two interviewers, well, sequentially, and they were sometimes both in the room. One was the CBI agent who'd been called in to investigate things in the jail and had been investigating various matters in the jail for a couple months at that point. The court's ruling on voluntariness of that focused on the fact that the court found that it was non-accusatory. I think that ignores the language in the Humphrey case and the Jennings case about subtle psychological coercion can make a statement involuntary. And I think that the tone of this interview and the emphasis on come clean, tell the truth is your salvation, being spoken to this woman who was suffering from some health issues that day, and the fact that she was reduced to tears within minutes of the start of this post-polygraph interview show that it is a coercive custodial venue.
Well, counsel, I tell you what troubles me about that argument is it seems to me that there's an argument that if an officer harshly questions a witness, well, that's coercion. And if an officer politely questions a witness, that's coercion.
I think that the emphasis should not be on the politeness, but on the psychological ploys being used.
And well, how is it a psychological ploy to say, please tell the truth?
I think the repeated emphasis on that and the way it was handled with come clean, tell the truth, you're not telling the truth, your poly was inconclusive, you're not telling the truth is your salvation. It was somewhat subtle, and I know that at least one of you is a parent. I'm sure that there were times when the father can elicit comments from a child that the child didn't want to give by acting in a fatherly manner. So I think that it's entirely possible to be psychologically coercive without beating someone with the rubber hose. I think that is the whole point of the Humphrey and Jennering cases. Now, as I recall, in Jennering, it was remanded for more findings on the issue of voluntariness. But I think that what we've got here, that there are definitely indications that this was not a voluntary statement.
Aren't the psychological coercion cases more in the line of the police manipulating a known not weakness, but a known sensitivity somehow. The fact that a person is emotional when they're discussing potential criminal charges, I would not think would qualify as one of the known weaknesses to which people would say, well, you're trying to manipulate, you know, psychologically manipulate that situation.
I agree with you in part, but here, the emphasis on the truth is your salvation being spoken to a woman who's deeply religious, who's insisting that she's not a liar, I think was really compelling. And I think that also the nature of the questioning, most of the questions were compound. And if you read the interview transcript, you'll see that Ms. Zadra was usually responding to the part of the questions about who she discussed the phone calls with, rather than when she learned that her statements had been false, and that her emphasis and her focus was on who she talked with, just as at the Strohmeyer hearing, she had focused on whether she had burned CDs of phone calls, which was her interpretation of the phrase recording phone calls, without recognizing that At least the defense, Strohmeyer, was concerned with the fact that the phone system itself recorded phone calls. So it was a question of understanding the question and giving the answer that was unambiguously.
Thank you, counsel.
I see my time is up. I ask you to reverse the convictions.
Well, I'm actually going to ask the bailiff to give you 2 minutes in rebuttal. I'm also going to ask the bailiff to give Mr. Lee 17 minutes if he wants to use it for him. Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of People, bar number 38141. On the jury verdict form issue, just a couple of points on that. First, there is no law, as defense counsel conceded, that you need to have all of the elements restated in the jury verdict form.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, counsel. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Judge.
But I guess the problem with this verdict form is that it for some reason, included some of the elements, but not all of them. I mean, it seems to me it didn't have to include any of them, but having included some of them, didn't it have to include all of them to avoid misleading the jury?
I don't think so. I would disagree that the way it was written would mislead the jury for the same reasons we articulated in the brief. Basically, what we have is guilty, not guilty, and then the charge. So here's the act of which you can find the defendant committed or not committed. But again, it is all subsequent to the guilty or not guilty. So given the context that we had a trial on all these charges, it seems that the most reasonable reading is just that that's a list of the charge. So the jury specifically knows which of the verdict forms goes to each count of perjury.
Well, what would be the purpose of adding that language to the verdict form? Why was it even necessary?
I think in this case, it was just to try and keep everyone on the same page. We have lots of different perjury counts in this case. Just to kind of clarify that the jury was in fact finding and unanimously agreeing on each count for which statements constituted that perjury charge.
Didn't all the perjury charges, weren't they all formulated the same way? Not guilty when she gave this false statement, guilty when she gave this false statement. And by the way, doesn't it assume when she gave this false statement? That's not really an elements or the charge. That's an assumption, isn't it? In both the not guilty and guilty.
I would disagree with what I think is the problematic piece of your question is that it said false. My recollection of the verdict forms is it didn't say when the defendant provided the false statement of. It just said the statement of. So it didn't assume an element, which is, I think, the critical problem with the defendant's arguments. And again, I think when you look at the instructions in the whole context of trial, although I think this court has pointed out, although superfluous, it certainly wasn't prejudicial nor was it misleading. The instructions, the verdict forms just states what the perjury count was charging. So either when she did do this or she didn't do this. Even assuming that it was misleading for a couple of different reasons, any error was harmless. First of all, there's no dispute that the elemental instructions were correct. The court's instructions also provided expressly that the people had to prove all of the elements before the jury could find the defendant guilty. So I don't think there's taking the instructions as a whole, I don't think there could be any doubt that the jury didn't find all the necessary elements before signing the verdict form. Second, as this court's case has made clear, this court also considers the people and the defense's closing arguments. No one ever disputed to trial that it wasn't the people's burden to prove all the elements. Both sides expressly stated that it was. And third, and most importantly, I think opposing counsel's admitted today that whether or not the statements were made, whether or not the defendant made the statements, that was never an issue trial. That was undisputed. The only issue is whether or not at the time she knew they were false. And nothing about the verdict forms has any bearing on that.
So at trial, the issue was not whether she had given a false statement. It was whether she had knowingly made a false statement.
Yes, correct. And I don't think there's any dispute over that, not in the briefs and not in oral argument today. And that entirely resolves the jury verdict form issue. Moving to the suppression issue, the record amply confirms the trial court's conclusion. On the custody issue, there's just no basis in the record to find the defendant was in custody. The police invited, did not demand for the defendant to attend. The defendant issued or signed a polygraph form saying that she was there voluntarily. At the end of it, she signed the form saying that she was treated fairly throughout the proceeding. No, as the trial court found and the record supports, a conversational tone was used throughout the interrogation. She was expressly advised she could leave and there were no physical restraints. Given the totality of circumstances, there's just no basis to find the defendant was in custody.
What about Agent Haynes' comments? I know you want to go, I'll let you go in just a little bit. How does that play into the custodial analysis?
I think that, taken with all of the other comments, it doesn't turn into custodial interrogation. The bottom line is the defendant was advised expressly at the very beginning, whenever you want to go, no questions asked, you can leave. Nothing about that statement vitiates an earlier warning that she could leave or changes any of the other factors present in the interrogation, which all confirm that it just, and a reasonable person in the defendant's position would have felt free to terminate the encounter and leave. As to whether or not these statements of the officer for the defendant to tell the truth somehow made the statements involuntary, I think, as this court's kind of pointed out, the cases kind of create, there's a very broad line between using convincing language and coercive language. And simply encouraging the defendant to tell the truth, I mean, however painful it might be for the defendant to do so, does not mean that the police used coercive interrogating tactics, rendering the confession voluntary. And then I guess the only other argument raised today was the statement by Agent Haynes explaining why he continued asking the defendant questions or interrogation because he didn't believe her. As this court pointed out on Monday, the Supreme Court in Davis found that such testimony is properly admissible. So if the court has no further questions, I'd ask you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for allowing me rebuttal time. I do think that with the phrasing of the verdict forms, with some of the elements, omission of knowing when that was really the critical component was definitely prejudicial to the defendant, because that's really what the jury needed to decide. And when it signed the verdict forms without that having that component, when other things were there, really was prejudicial to the defense here. And at least two of the verdict forms include providing false information. Count three was the false reporting, is when she provided false information to the CBI. Count 13 was whether she provided false information to the DA and stated that she gave false information. So I think that the knowing element is critical in this case and is a basis by itself for reversing the verdicts. I think as to the suppression component, the fact that the people emphasized that Ms. Vadra appeared voluntarily for this interview. This was an interview based on her conduct and her employment, her role as the captain of the jail. And if she had not participated in these interviews, she probably would have been fired. There was nothing voluntary about this. She was fighting to preserve her job and that she was performing her job properly. And that was the first level of coercion in this. The statements about you're free to leave at any time, she had to answer these questions to prove that she was performing her job properly and that she was doing things correctly in the performance of her job. And I think that that is really critical to understanding the first element of coercion and the fact that Agent Haynes says, well, you can go in a little bit. All of these things roll together to form a coercive custodial environment for her.
So had you made that argument about, you know, her employment status was itself a coercive circumstance in your brief?
I think I referenced it slightly, but I did not emphasize it. I know that.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. The case will be submitted and opinion will issue in due course. Thank you both for your argument.